Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 317 for Monday, February 28th, 2011.
Welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab here in sunny New Hampshire. Oh, it's not sunny at all today, John. It's rainy and dreary. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, which is rainy and dreary, but it's warm. It's a balmy 52 degrees here. I mean, it's almost spring. Yes, John F. Braun.
Hi, John F. Braun. So, yeah, we are the Mac Geek Gab. We come here every week, unless we take a week off like we did last week, because I was on vacation. And we come here every week to share tips, answer questions, share some experiences, and essentially try to enhance and increase your knowledge of all things Mac and Apple and technical and all that stuff. So, John, you know, I was on vacation last week, as I mentioned, and we took a trip out to San Francisco with the family, which was great. While I was gone, I took it as a good opportunity, and I'm going to do more of this testing while I'm at Macworld Expo here. Macworld Expo. It's South by Southwest here down in Austin. Oh, later. Well, I guess it's not March yet, but later in March.
So you weren't you didn't unplug, because I know you've taken vacations where you would vow to be off the grid, but I guess this was not one of them.
Yeah. So we were on the grid, I'll take a minute and talk about why. There were a couple of reasons we remained on the grid this vacation. One was we wound up renting an apartment as opposed to renting a hotel. We rented an apartment from I found a website actually called HomeAway.com, and it turned onto it by a Super Bowl ad of all things years ago when Lisa and I had first visited San Francisco. We stayed in an apartment there, and we found it because someone I knew someone. It was, you know, kind of a sort of a buddy deal thing. And it was great because, you know, you get to live in a neighborhood and you have more room, and it's usually much cheaper and all that stuff than a hotel. So during the Super Bowl, I saw an ad for HomeAway.com, and it was fantastic. It was exactly the same kind of thing, but now it's kind of just a website that puts people together. So we found this apartment. We stayed in the Lower Haight. Three bedrooms, real quick, three bedrooms. I think it was 1,800 square feet. We had a living room, full kitchen, all that stuff. $150 a night. You just can't beat this stuff. And so part of the reason we stayed online was that being in the Lower Haight, that's not a neighborhood I know, even though we're in San Francisco all the time. I just don't know that neighborhood. So having things available like Yelp and all that was quite good. Of course, also having access to Google Maps. Now, this doesn't really tie into the conversation we're about to have about different Wi-Fi hotspots, but having access to Google Maps and the way that it integrates and guides you through the San Francisco Muni system, the bus system and the trains, was fantastic. It really allowed us to get around everywhere. So and a bunch of my Twitter followers were the ones that recommended that I just go with Google Maps and I should be fine. And they were absolutely right. It worked out so well because the phone's got GPS, the iPhone or really an Android phone or anything has GPS and knows where you are. And then it also has links to the bus system. So it'll tell you, yeah, you'd say, wow. I want to get from here to there. And it says, great. Yeah. Walk two blocks to this corner. Wait there for the bus. The next bus is due in 7 minutes, right? All the buses have GPS on them. So the predictions we found were amazingly accurate. You know, it's like, get on this bus, take it to here, you know, transfer to this bus, take it there and you're good to go or whatever, you know, whatever the options were. And
I've had the same experience traveling to New York City is that, yeah. So you use Google Maps and then they'll have a public.
Yep.
Well, they'll have a number of options. They're like, do you want to walk?
Right.
You know, they give you walking directions. They'll give you driving directions, which if you're driving in New York City, you're insane, in my opinion. Well, or the subway and the bus system. And yeah, they'll give you either or. You can do all subway, bus hybrid, stuff like that. So I'm very impressed with Google Maps public transportation
options. It wasn't always the most efficient thing. By the end of the week, we realized, oh, wait a minute. You know, if we do that, we've got to change buses. But if we go, you know, one block in this direction, we can just go straight there. That sort of thing. So it wasn't picking the absolute best route, at least by our interpretation. But it was picking a route. And to not have to memorize the bus routes, that was huge. Once we did know better, we could do, you know, we did what we wanted, but it was very, very handy. Loved it. Mm-hmm. Absolutely loved it. So I took this as an opportunity to check out a couple of different personal Wi-Fi hotspots. I'm going to define that as being any device that allows you to get to take a wireless cell phone data signal and rebroadcast it as a personal Wi-Fi hotspot. So the Verizon MiFi, or really the MiFi, which can be bought from a number of different carriers, the MiFi is the classic kind of incarnation of this, right? It gets its signal from the cell network. The one I have is a Verizon MiFi, but it gets it from Verizon. It then broadcasts it, and it's this little battery powered hotspot that's, you know, about the size of maybe a little smaller than an iPhone, actually quite a bit smaller, maybe half the size of an iPhone, and broadcasts it for up to five users, and, you know. All that.
So this could be a 3G or for the most part, a 3G or 4G data signal that it's converting to Wi-Fi.
Yeah, that's right. Although you certainly could do it with the, you know, the slower, the 2G stuff, edge and all that. So I tested four different things. I tested the Verizon MiFi, as I discussed. I tested AT&T over my iPhone with tethering, and it may or may not be jailbroken to make that happen. And then I tested I talked a little bit about this a couple of weeks ago, but I bought from Virgin Mobile. I bought the LG Optimus 5 phone, which is an Android phone, but it connects to Virgin Mobile's network, which here in the US is Sprint. And use that as a hotspot because the phone will allow that if you install the right software. And then I also tested this thing from a company called Clear that is a 3G. It's not a phone. It's just the hotspot. And it's like the their equivalent of a MiFi. So those are the four things that I tested. I guess they call it their personal mobile internet hotspot. No. I don't have the model right here in front of me. It is the ClearSpot 4G Plus is what I was testing. So very interesting results. Before I left, I tested everything here at my home in Durham, New Hampshire, and where I cannot get a 4G signal, it's fine. So I had 3G signals on everything, and the clearly the fastest thing was the iPhone. I don't think it's any great surprise, but AT&T's 3G network is regularly being reported as the fastest one. I was getting, you know, 2 to 3 megabits down and over 1 megabit up on AT&T. So that was you know, to me that was fine. The rest of them all kind of fell into the same range, getting, and that's the ClearSpot 4G Plus, the Verizon MiFi, and then the Virgin America phone, Virgin Mobile phone. Virgin America is the airline. I was getting about 1 maybe to 1.5 megabits down, and then anywhere between 0.3 and 0.5 megabits up. And that was all the same for these three different devices. I believe ClearSpot was using Nextel's 3G network, which is the same 3G network that, or Sprint's, which is the same that Virgin Mobile was using. But the interesting part was 4G, and that was the same. 3G speeds were the same wherever I was, or at least wherever I tested it. The ClearSpot 4G Plus, I happened to test it while we were waiting in the terminal at Boston Logan. And I got a 4G signal and got killer connections. I got almost 5 megabits down, and then about 1.5 up was what I was doing on the 4G connection. And that worked really well. That worked nicely. Unfortunately, in San Francisco, and I've got to check in with them and see why this is, but unfortunately in San Francisco, at least where we stayed in this apartment in the Lower Haight, I could get no 4G signal. I even tried going outside. There just was none. So I was not able to test it, but I was able to run it on 3G and again got about that, you know, that
really
1 to 1.5 and about 0.5 megabit up. Yeah.
Yeah, because now I had, now just to contrast, Dave, is that, as you know, I think I mentioned, is that they gave me a different device, which is a pure, it's a USB, I'll call modem. It a USB radio modem.
Okay.
Which is either 3G or 4G. Now, fortunately, now both where I am, the city next to me, Bridgeport, they just activated service. And,
okay.
And with that, I get pretty good. I get about 3 megabits up and 3 down, which is pretty good, especially the up. I mean, that's faster than my cable modem. But when I was in San Francisco, you know, so I'm, you know, I have a review of this in the works, but the speed that I got in San Francisco was the best of all the speeds I saw. I got 7 megabits down, 4 megabits up using speedtest.net. So their 4G, when it works, is smoking. Now, the only thing that I found, I'll just give you the very quick feedback. So if you're inside a big metal tube, and I want to follow up with them to find out about this, but either when I was on the train, so they also claim to have service in New York City.
Yep.
My experience is if you're in a big metal tube, whether it be a train or an airplane, I don't know if it's because of the frequency that 4G uses, but then it didn't work right for me. I had to back off to 3G.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
But when the 4G works and you're in a major city, oh man, it is. And I think their 4G plans are typically unlimited, which is another shocker.
Okay. Okay.
At least for the device I have, I think it's $55 a month and it's unlimited 4G, which, you know, like unlimited, does unlimited really mean unlimited? And I think in their case, unless you go nuts, it does, which is pretty cool. So I just have some nice things to say about Clear in general, in that when I was at Macworld, the speeds were great.
Good. Okay. Yeah. And it's, you know, it is definitely one of those your mileage may vary things. And from what I understand, 4G is far more temperamental right now than 3G. So and we'll find out more from the Clear folks as well. But, you know, they all worked great. I want to take a minute and talk a little bit more about this Virgin Mobile, this phone, because it's an interesting thing. It was $150. Now, this is an Android phone running 2.2 and you download an app called Quick Settings to it, and that enables you to turn on and off the Wi-Fi hotspot. And the Wi-Fi hotspot shows up in infrastructure mode, just like an airport base station and all of that stuff. So, you know, it works fine. And with Virgin Mobile, it's interesting. You know, I bought the phone for $150. There is no contract, no nothing. And then for $25, I can get a plan that gives me a month, 30 whatever days, of 300 minutes and unlimited data. Now, again, unlimited may mean something different to everyone, but you know, for traveling, that $25 to be able to essentially turn this device on and into a hotspot for me for, you know, if I'm going to be in a hotel more than 2 days, I've just, you know, I'm going to spend more than $25 on Wi-Fi, and it's probably not going to work all that well, at least in most hotels. But this device, you know, it's your own connection and you're good to go. So check coverage maps, but this Optimus 5, it's a good little option, and it also gives you some minutes on the phone. So, the Clear Spot is pretty cool. It's got a digital display on it, so it tells you right on the display what network you're connected to, and whether it's 3G or 4G, your signal strength. It also, and you can turn this off, but it will give you the name of the wireless network and the password right on the front of it. So so very handy if it's not something you're using every day and you happen to forget or need to connect a new computer to it, you can just look at it. Now again, you can go in and turn that off if you want to be more secure about it. But the AT&T one using MyWi on the iPhone, that shows up as an ad hoc device. So we've had some trouble with that, especially with other third party devices in the past. And it only does web encryption. The Virgin Mobile one and the ClearSpot all do, you know, WPA, WPA2, et cetera. So they all worked fine. But yeah, this Virgin Mobile thing was interesting. And it was interesting, you know, John, to play with an Android phone. I tried really hard to like it. And there are some cool things about Android. It's just way more tweakable and way more customizable.
Oh, It looks like an iPhone.
It does. You know what I came up with, and you know, I have to remember that I'm coming into this having used iOS for years, and you know, I've got days, you know, probably single digit, maybe double digit days of experience using Android. So please bear that in mind with what I'm about to say. But my feeling after using Android and really forcing myself to use it, I actually left the iPhone back at the apartment a couple of days and just used the Android phone while we were out and about, because I wasn't expecting any calls from people that, you know, need to get me on my iPhone. I was on vacation, so I was free to be able to kind of mess around with it. And the experience or the thought that I came away with was, gosh, this is my fear of what iOS will be like if Steve Jobs isn't there anymore to kind of crack the whip and make sure this, you know, that things don't get, the feature bloat doesn't happen, essentially. And I realize, you know, that at least I hope that there are far more people at Apple than just Steve that get this concept now and are committed to it. And hopefully that's the case for the company going forward. But yeah.
What are you saying? The apps were what? Inconsistent?
No, I'm not talking about the apps. The user interface is inconsistent.
You know, all right.
It's got this cool thing. Like, so, you know, you load a bunch and I like the concept better, the implementation, not so much. On your iPhone, every time you install an app, it just gets added to, you know, yet another page of screens. Right. And to me, that's kind of a pain in the neck, you know, because I want to be able to configure things. And there's certain apps that I use all the time that I want to have close by. And the rest, really, I just want a big, long list of the apps that are there. And I usually search for them with Spotlight anyway. So what I wind up having is a bunch of folders, you know, way out on my last screen. And I just dump, and I call them keep on iPhone 1, keep on iPhone 2, keep on iPhone 3. And I just dump kind of random apps in there and only pull out the ones that I'm actually going to use. But I want them all there. With Android, apps are not, you have the same sort of idea with these home screens, but apps are not automatically added to the screen when you add them to the device. They're added to a list of apps. And again, you can pull them out of the list and put them on whatever home screen you want, but your home screens aren't just being constantly, you know, barfed on with every app that gets installed. And so that's kind of cool. But here's the thing. The home screens, you swipe left and right. Very, very straightforward, you know, comfortable for an iPhone user, no problem. You know, and Android, like I said, Android does that the same way. You click on the list. There's a little button that you click on to pull up the list of all the apps. And now suddenly I'm scrolling up and down. And it took me a second. It's like, got it. And it's just these little inconsistencies in the path through the OS that make me think, gosh, someone clearly Google has smart people on their staff. There's no question about this, right? But they just don't clearly do not have people committed to making the user experience clean. What they, you know, they've prioritized features over user experience. And that's too bad because the Android's cool. It, you know, there's some things about it that I really like. The customization is great. It's a great thing to tweak. You know, I mean, it's kind of like the whole, you know, 10 years ago, Windows versus the Mac kind of thing where it was, yeah, you know, you can do more on Windows, but it's not nearly as smooth as I'd ever want it to be. So, but definitely a cool little device.
All right.
Yeah. So that's my little ramble about all that. So
yeah, I like the clear 4G device for no other reason. The other thing I did during my travels, and then we'll move on here, but, you know, so I was also, if I had a preference between public Wi-Fi, which I think I got fortunate in every airport that I went to, Dave. So between Bradley, Philadelphia, San Francisco, which didn't used to be the case. I think I was also in Charlotte, North Carolina, I think. They all had free Wi-Fi, which is really nice. But here's the problem. Now, you've heard of Fire Sheep.
Yes.
And at least when I was at Bradley, so I showed up early because there was bad weather. But then, you know, of course, I got stuck in Philly.
Right.
Fire Sheep works great for hijacking people's Facebook.
Oh, yeah, of course it does, right?
I think of all the things I found, so some people have dealt with the issue in that even if you grab the session cookie, if you try to do anything funky, they'll ask for the password again, which, right, of course, I didn't know. But I grabbed at least one Facebook cookie and one Windows Live cookie where when I clicked on the Fire Sheep thing, I was in that person's account. Mm-hmm. I saw their life. I could see their messages. Not that I did anything. Again, I'm a good guy.
Sure.
In general. But I was just curious. And I think actually I've noticed as of late Facebook, which I don't really use that much, but I think Facebook has actually moved to the same model where if you try to do anything sensitive or modify anything important, it comes up and says, oh, by the way, can you give me your password again? Which is really as it should be. I don't know if it's quite, well, I don't know if I call it two-factor authentication, but two-phase. But
right.
Lots of a well-designed site should, before you do anything, not assume that the session cookie is the be-all, end-all of who you say you are. Right. So I think people are addressing it slowly, but that's what freaked me out. If I had a choice between the two, I'd much rather trust my data over a 3G, 4G network than a open Wi-Fi network.
Right.
Is what I'm going to say.
Yeah. All right, cool. Right. We have a bunch of questions to get to. Before we do, I want to tell you all about our first sponsor, which is Notebook by Circus Ponies at circusponies.com. Notebook is an app both for the Mac and for the iPad that allows you to create, well, virtual notebooks of data that kind of makes sense to you in whatever form you want. If you might be taking a class, you might be working on a project at the office, you might be planning an event at home, and you want to store all the data related to that event in one place. And Notebook is the place to do that. When you start out, you're typing into a virtual notebook where you see white lined paper and you can add your hierarchies and all that. But then the cool part is you can also drag in just about anything. You can drag in URLs, PDFs, pictures, other media. We've got people that listen to the Geek Gab here right on in their notebook. They pull the audio from the show into the notebook and start playing it. And then they can take notes and add URLs and widgets and all that stuff right in there. Very, very cool stuff and very, very handy. There is, of course, a free trial. And if you haven't used Notebook before, I highly recommend that you go and check out their free trial at circusponies.com. Once you're ready to buy, it's $29.99 for the iPad and $49.95 for the Mac. If you are a student, there is a $20 discount you can get. So you can get it for $29.95 on the Mac, but the iPad pricing, of course, stays the same because there is no discounted pricing available from Apple for the iPad. All of this you can check out at circusponies.com. All right. And then with that, John, it's time to get on to Rick. And Rick writes, one of my Mac user group friends uses Aperture much more than iPhoto. Quick View in Mail has an option of saving to iPhoto. Can this be changed to save to Aperture? I've been trying to make a Finder plugin with Automator using information I got online, but I don't know where to put it or even if that's the right approach. So, John, you're our resident Aperture guy, so why don't you take this one?
Well, recently, because so I've been a longtime iPhoto user, but yep. Recently, because of the deal through the App Store and because iPhoto doesn't do good with large libraries like the one I had, which was about 80 gigabytes and about 10 years worth of pictures. Aperture is just the next step up. And so for $79, I decided to, you know, get it, migrate all my stuff over.
Sure.
And frustratingly enough, Dave, so the thing is, a lot of the applications on the Mac, like iWeb and others who are aware of Apple Photo apps, the ones that used to show iPhoto as an option will, if you have Aperture, show Aperture as an additional option. This was not the case. So in this case, and I think what he's talking about is not Quick Look, but I think it's Quick View, Dave. No, it is Quick Look. He's correct.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
No. He said Quick View, but what the technology is really called, Dave, is Quick Look. And this is something that you can invoke not only from Mail, but from the Finder, is that if you highlight something and you say Quick Look, and you know, I'm not being very specific, but suffice to say, within Mail, if you highlight a graphic or a document or something like that, and maybe you could find it for me while I'm babbling here, but if you say open in Quick Look, what happens is Quick Look will look at the type of file and then bring up a viewer which is specific to that file. Now, if it's a graphic like a JPEG or that's, I think, what he's saying.
Yep.
It'll say, well, add it to iPhoto. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, then if you have Aperture, it should say add it to Aperture. It doesn't.
Right.
Now, I think there's a reason for this because and this is what shocked me when I got Aperture. So when I got the iFi card, the nice thing about the iFi is that it would upload pictures to your computer. And then when you open iPhoto, it would magically import them. And I'm like, how is it doing this? Well, I know exactly how it's doing this, or I have a very strong suspicion, is that if you open up the iPhoto package, Dave, Inside of that is a folder called auto import, and I'm almost positive. So it's not visible, but I think it's sort of like an API. So the applications know that you have iPhoto, they'll stuff the pictures in the auto import folder. And as soon as you open iPhoto, immediately it imports all those photos into a new project, or it just imports them.
Well, isn't there another way to do that? I mean, you can take a picture and drag it on the app icon, either in the Finder or in the dock, right?
And
I think there's a way that applications can send data to other applications and bypass the auto import folder. I think there is. Yeah.
No, you're correct. Now, one way to do it, but I see that as kind of caveman, is to, drag the picture over the aperture icon and it'll import it. To me, that's a given, but I'm not going to make an assumption. So that's one way to do it, is to highlight the photo or photos and drag them over the aperture icon in your dock, and that should work just fine.
Right.
But I want to get a little more sophisticated. And because the question Rick asked is, hey, you know, can I do this with Automator? And actually, it turns out this is what I ended up doing. So I really wanted that iFi functionality. So one thing the iFi software does, it says, well, hey, I can either import your photos into iPhoto, which, of course, you know, it's using that mechanism I mentioned, or I can copy it to a folder on your computer for you. I'm like, okay, let's do that. And here's what I eventually ended up doing. So someone out there actually wrote a plugin, which I looked at. So the Aperture site at Apple actually has a list. I mean, one of the nice things about Aperture is there are a boatload of plugins. Like, we actually used one to do our gallery picture upload, which is very nice. But I actually developed one, Dave, that was just two steps in Automator. So he was on the right path.
Okay.
Because what I wanted is, so iFi, the way I have it set up now, will deliver all the pictures that are on the iFi card to a specific folder on my Mac. The thing is, how do I get them into Aperture? And the answer is yes, you use Automator. And there are two steps here. So one step, when you build, and I built an Automator application. So the first step is you select Get Specified Finder Items. And this is basically a step in Automator where you say, get all the items from this specific folder, which in this case was the folder the iFi put all the pictures in, and get ready to and submit this to the next step. Then the next step, fortunately, is Automator offers an action called import photos.
Right.
And that was it. And basically the input is from the prior step. So I created a two-step application. And then what you say is add to and choose the project. So what I do is I have a ever existing project in Aperture called iFi. And so that's what I would suggest, is you could call it import whatever. And then the nice thing is you can also have a checkbox in the import photo step that's made, that's advertised by Aperture, saying delete source images, which I think is what you'd want to do. So basically what happens is, once that folder is full of enough photos that I want to submit to a project in Aperture, I basically take all... I just double click on that action, and it automatically sucks all the photos out of that folder, deletes them, and then imports them into a project in Aperture.
So you could, I have an idea for you and for Rick's, Rick's friend in the user group there, make your Automator action and then activate it as a folder action. Right. So
I was thinking about that. Yes.
Right click on this iFi folder and do a folder action. And then actually you wouldn't even need to say get specified finder items, because it's going to happen. The Automator action will take input from that. So you just do your import photos and off you go. And that way, anything you dump in there will get imported. And then if you check that box, deleted, and boom, you're good to go. It saves you a step.
Good call.
Yep. All right. That's cool. I like this. All right. Moving on to Greg. Greg has a question, but in the course of asking his question, shines a light on something that's cool to talk about here. Greg writes, I'm having a problem with hot corners staying put over time. I have my lower right corner set to show the desktop, but only when the command key is depressed. It works for several days, and then all of a sudden I accidentally move my mouse down there and it shows me my desktop without me holding down the required command key. Very annoying. When I look at my preferences, sure enough, the command key is no longer required. I then reset it to require the command key, and all is well until some point in the future when it will again lose its requirement for the command key. Okay, so what he was talking about here was something of which I was unaware. It works. If you go into System Preferences and click on Expose in Spaces, At least in the current build of Snow Leopard, the first section you'll see at the top of that is called active screen corners. And this is where you can set things up exactly like Greg describes. You can set one corner of the screen to go to sleep, one corner of the screen to never go to sleep, one to activate the screensaver, et cetera, et cetera. However, and by each of these corners is a little drop down menu and you can pick, you know, what they do. But Greg talked about doing it with the command key. And he's right. If instead of just clicking on one of those menus in the active screen corners space in that preference pane, if you hold down the command key and click the menu, you'll see that every option in the list has the command key down. And the same works with option control. Yeah. So what
I'm doing it now. It's live. Wow. It's awesome. Amazing.
Yeah, it's awesome. So
but why is it awesome?
Well, because one of the reasons I've never used active screen corners is because my mouse constantly drifts around the screen. I have it set to be pretty touchy because I like it to move fast. And it's not rare for me to hit the corners of the screen. And right. And to have it go black when I hit a certain corner drives me crazy. But if I could do it with the command key down, well,
I'm with you. All right. Because that signals intent rather than an accident.
Right.
Okay. Now I get it. Oh, that is it's not documented. I never knew that.
I know.
Oh man.
So that's the cool part of this. The uncool part is that Greg knew about this. So thanks for unintentionally informing not only us, but all the rest of your listening brethren, Greg. But now you have a problem, right? Cause it won't stick like this. And so what I did was I opened up my home library preferences folder and sorted it by date modified. And then I started mucking about with setting some active screen corners. And the reason I had that window open is I wanted to see what preference file was being modified. And what immediately floated to the top was not obvious. It was com.apple.doc.plist. So home, library, preferences, and then com.apple.doc.plist is where all of these things are stored. And I confirmed it by opening up the plist file. And at the very end, there was this new definition for a hot corner. So it's possible you've got a damaged dock system preferences. And if that's the case, you've got, well, two options. One is you can open it in plist editor or text wrangler or BB edit if you have it to see if you can find and repair any corruption manually. The second option, which is not optimal, but would work, is to throw the file away and just have the system and then reboot and have the system rebuild it. You'll lose not only your dock preferences, but obviously all these other ones too. But if that's what it takes to fix it, well, maybe that's it. Although I hear Mr. Braun chomping at the bit. So maybe there is a third option for you, Greg.
Well, you didn't hear me, but I was going to say, Dave, you're just dying to know, how can you tell if you have a corrupt preference file?
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you because I just remember this in the back of my mind because I was repairing my drive the other day. And our friend Onyx has an option. So if you fire up Onyx and you go to verify, there is a preferences tab. And they actually have a little checkbox here. So they have two checkboxes. One is to verify user preferences and system preferences, which of course is either in the high level library preferences directory or the home directory library preferences directory. But they have a little checkbox saying show only corrupt preference files. So you may want to run that every now and then. Yeah. So I think by corrupt, it determines, well, I don't know what the heck it means. I think it means if the data in the pref file is not of the type that is expected. Right. So this is something that you probably may want to do every now and then. And once or twice I've had it and it'll highlight it. And that's a clear sign that you want to jettison that pref file. And I think it'll do it for you. Or if it doesn't, then at least you know where it is and you can get rid of it. But yeah, I'm with you. Sometimes, you know, things just go bad and you got to get rid of the pref file.
Yeah.
But thought I'd toss in about Onyx. I mean, we just love it to death. It's it solves so many problems.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's awesome. Cool. All right. Moving on to a tip from Jeff about our last non-premium show, number 315.
Hey, John and Dave. It's Jeff from Denver, Colorado. I was just listening to episode 315. The anonymous caller who was having the Time Machine issue of wanting an extra 60 gigabytes beyond his space used on the internal drive. I've actually run across this issue on a number of occasions where I will plug in another external hard drive that does not happen to be in the excluded list from Time Machine, and Time Machine suddenly bloats up, wants a lot more space than it originally needs. And I've oftentimes had it where I'll end up losing a lot of my older backups as it's deleting those old ones to make room for that new hard drive I've attached. The solution to that is to go into System Preferences, open up Time Machine, and add that other external drive to the excluded list. This is where you cut me off.
All right. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Jeff. And, you know, where this is most important is if you take our advice and also clone your hard drive, you know, on a regular basis, because any drive that's attached to your machine physically, either i.e. not over a network. And of course, a network connection could be physical, too. But anything that's either, you know, internal to your machine or USB FireWire or eSATA connections to the machine will automatically be backed up by Time Machine. And and going into, as he said, System Preferences, Time Machine, click Options, and then you can add that drive to the exclusions list. And it will remember that even if the drive's ejected and comes back, it will remember that exclusions list. So, you know, the last thing you want is, if you're cloning your boot drive, is to have Time Machine backing the cloned copy too. That's, you know, taking a lot of space.
And so some way to know this. So one, and I don't always notice this, but there's two ways to know if this is happening, Dave. So one is, and again, you may not always see this, but you'll see the, you know, pulsing, you know, eye or whatever in the spotlight, you know, magnifying glass. You'll see that dot. Now, I don't always notice it, but I think the other way to notice it, Dave, is if you're running any utility that monitors what's going on, like iStat menus, you're probably going to see, I believe it's MD Worker.
Well, that's not busy. Time Machine, though. That's just Spotlight re-indexing.
Oh wait,
itself.
I'm sorry. No, is it Backup D? I'm sorry. Is it backup D? No, it's Backup D.
And
so
and
you see Backup D doing stuff.
The dot in the Spotlight is not related to this.
No, you're right. I'm sorry, but no.
That's
all right. I'm confusing Spotlight but no, if you see Backup D, you know, getting down. Then yeah, that's why, because it's doing what it thinks it should.
Right.
So yeah, now I've had that. I think they've gotten over this problem, but I've on occasion seen Time Machine try to back up Time Machine drives, which I think they got over that. Or maybe that's when you're well, no, I've seen that. And sometimes you may have to explicitly, I mean, I suppose it couldn't hurt to drag a Time Machine drive into that exclusion list as well. But no, I've seen that on occasion. I think it was a bug, or maybe, you know, like we pointed out, maybe a damaged prep file. But I've seen that happen where, you know, I plug in a drive and I'm like, what are you doing? Why are you backing up the backup drive?
Yeah. Yeah, that's
well,
bad.
I think it's if you have two separate, right. I guess sometimes it doesn't know. So anyways, moving on.
Cool. Yeah. So let's move to, well, we can do Robin. That's fine. It's any chance I can get to chat about this one particular technology, I'm happy to do. So we'll make this quick. Robin says, I know you've talked about certain products in other episodes that may be able to help me in part, but I can't seem to put them all together to get a solution. I would like to get rid of my traditional landline and switch to my home phone connected to my cable via Ooma or some other low cost voice over IP plan. The problem is that my cable enters my house at a place where there is no phone jack close by, and where my phone jacks are located, there isn't an easy or cheap or attractive way to run a cable to it. My options are to either run the cable over the tile floor in front of the bathroom door, over the outside of the door, or completely around the entire bathroom floor. I'm in a townhouse, so I won't be doing any major renovation either. However, near the cable and near the phone jacks, there is AC access. I'm wondering if there is something I can plug into the AC jack, or perhaps set up a relay from my wireless router near the phone jack. Any help you can give me? Okay, good. So yes, you're absolutely right. And you're close. So to summarize, the idea is what she wants to do is take a voice over IP solution, an Oomla, OOMLA. Yeah. Is a very low cost one, but there are others. But what it is, it's a device that has an Ethernet port on it and a phone jack on it. And it connects, it uses your cable modem or whatever broadband connection you have to connect to their various servers over the internet. Vonage works the same way. And then it has a little relay in there that lets you treat it like a normal phone line. You can plug normal phones into it. You can even, as Robin clearly wants to do, plug it into your phone jack and feed all the phones in your home. So this is a cool thing. But, of course, the device has to be centrally located somewhere where there is both cable or at least Ethernet and telephone access nearby. And that is where Powerline comes in. So we've talked about using Powerline as the bridge to extend an Ethernet connection from one router to another to extend an airport network or a wireless network. Well, you could use it for the same reason here. You could plug Powerline adapters in to the AC jacks near both your phone and near your cable modem, and then plug the Ethernet from your cable modem or your router or whatever into the Powerline jack on one end, and then Ethernet into your Oomla or whatever voice over IP router you have on the other end. And in theory, it will just magically work. I've had great luck with Powerline here. I use the Netgear AV Plus 200s, but there are others that should work just fine. Just make sure they're 200 megabits or even faster. There are some 500 megabit per second models coming out. So,
or more, I think I've seen in the past.
Nobody's got anything faster than, I don't think there's anything on the market faster than 200 right now. Netgear is about to come out with their 500 megabit per second model. So, you're fine.
But that's all moot with Thunderbolt, right? No, we won't talk about that because many people have, and we won't.
We
yet.
Could. Yeah.
Well, we will eventually. It's a I shouldn't mention that it's the up and coming communication, high speed communication standard on Macs, and Apple is on the ball here,
but not for networking. Right? Thunderbolt is Intel's Lightpeak technology, right? And apparently Apple and Intel work closely together. This is on the new MacBook Pros, which were introduced. I actually got to play with them in San Francisco last week, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah.
At the Apple Store?
At the Apple Store, yeah. We were just happened through Union Square.
Well, I differ with you, because to me, Lightpeak appears to be a application neutral technology, and that, yeah, so it's supposed to. So again, we're taking a tangent, but sometimes this is good. But Lightpeak is a technology. Now, you know, it's kind of misleading because the name Lightpeak implies that it's going to operate over fiber, which I think a lot of the R&D was done over fiber.
It can run over fiber still.
Well, I think it was originally intended to,
right.
But Apple's implementation is over copper. You know, and it reminds me of the days. Many years ago, Dave, you remember gigabit Ethernet? It was like, wow, this is great. And everybody was like, well, gigabit Ethernet needs fiber. And the thing is, as it turns out, for the most part, I think most people, at least in a consumer or low end space,
right,
run gigabit Ethernet just fine over copper.
Well,
and then you have the underlying protocol, which certainly you could run gigabit Ethernet over fiber. Why not?
Sure. The benefit of running Thunderbolt over copper versus fiber, or I should say Lightpeak, because Thunderbolt may never work over optical, and so to differentiate, the difference between running Lightpeak over fiber versus copper is that on copper you can also send power, so devices that require bus power can get it over a copper connection, whereas over obviously a light connection that's not going to optical connection. That's not.
I think it was I think it's 10 watts. I think they provide, which is
enough for a laptop.
You know, that was my concern. So first, when I read about Lightpeak, I'm like, well, if it's running over fiber, I mean, last I checked, fiber optics don't do a really good job of transmitting power. As a matter of fact, they do a terrible job. Yes,
they're quite good as insulators in that sense.
So that was my question. Now, I'm wondering if they're going to eventually move to a fiber copper hybrid, which is what happens in a lot of networks, is that so you get the copper to carry the juice and you get the fiber to carry the data, and then everything's happy. But where are we going? But anyways, Lightpeak or Thunderbolt is now, from what I understand, Dave, though, is that it sounds like what's going to happen is you're going to have adapters, because my understanding is Thunderbolt is going to support, I think it's a all-in-one communication bus for both displays which I think we can put HDMI in there, which HDMI in itself supports not only video, but sound. Sure. So that's cool. But then the bus also supports data. But I think what's going to happen is you're going to have these adapters. So I think what's going to happen is you're going to have a Thunderbolt to USB adapter, a Thunderbolt right. to FireWire 800 adapter. So you're going to have all these adapters. But because you're using this common, very high speed bus, I think that's a good thing for everybody. Now, it's kind of funny because last I checked,
it's kind of like the express card slots, right? I mean, this replaces that in many ways. Because
Here's my fish shake. When I looked at the description of, and some people got back to me on this. So when I saw the description of what Thunderbolt is, they said it's the first, and Apple's PR, which, you know, okay, it's marketing and stuff. They said it's the first occasion where you're going to get PCI Express throughput on a computer bus. And I'm like, yeah, I thought Express Card kind of did that. And then,
right.
Some of my colleagues, I think Peter, you know, our friend Peter
Cullen,
who's out in San Francisco right now, actually pointed this out to me. Well, the problem is PCIe has multiple definitions. So right. The thing is, what they're saying is true in the sense that Thunderbolt is full bore PCI. The problem is PCIe has a number of definitions. You can have 1-bit channel or you can have a big old 16-bit channel.
Okay.
And the thing is, so as far as I can see, Thunderbolt supports the full, you know, really, really high throughput channel versus. So what they said is, I think, marketing speak, and that it's not the first occasion that you can do PCIe through a bus, but it's the fastest implementation you're going to get. And it should keep up with people's needs for quite a while.
Yeah.
So I'm excited. The only
cool.
thing, my only reflection is I'm not aware of any devices that use it.
Yeah, but then, there was okay. I'm trying to think. Was it LaCie that announced a drive on Thursday? Maybe that plugs directly into
okay.
to Lightbeat
and Drobo. Yeah. And I saw Drobo did a release. They yeah. said we're going to support it. So I think everybody's on the bandwagon. There's no question. It's the
six device maximum though on Lightpeak, right? So it's like we're back to the SCSI days.
Hopefully you don't need a Terminator.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, even FireWire arguably needed Terminators, but we just never used them. But there were many devices that would fail in the wrong spot.
Good tangent, though, because it's good for all of us who want our peripherals to operate at peak.
Well,
light,
you know,
or otherwise efficiency.
The nice part is, you know, many MacBook Pro users lamented the disappearance of the Express Card 34 slot
that held me back, Dave. I got to tell you the truth. The replacement on the low end. Now you can still get Express Card on the 17 inch. Well, not anymore, I guess. Or no, I think you still can. No, I believe the 17 inch MacBook Pro has both. Right. Maybe you can verify that for me.
I didn't remember seeing it
but
there.
But the thing is,
go ahead and check the specs. Check them.
Okay. But Apple basically got rid of the Express Card. So I think you and I have one of the last machines that Apple made that have the Express Card 34 slot built in.
Right.
Which, you know, on our machine, it's crippled. I think they uncrippled it. So ours is a 1.5 gigabit. I think on the future machines, they have a 3 gigabit per second SATA 2, you know, full SATA 2 implementation. But
yep.
then they went to which I thought was stupid, the SD slot, which is like, what, you know, that's not an expansion slot.
Right.
No, Express Card is an expansion slot because that allowed you to do USB or eSATA or whatever.
Well, and you're right. Yeah, the 17 inch has both Thunderbolt now and the Express Card 34. But
it's a battleship. Do I want that?
What Thunderbolt?
Maybe I do.
What Thunderbolt gives you is the ability to do that. Right. Not only can you connect your USB or your FireWire devices or your display, but in theory, because it's this, you know, uber wide pipe direct to the motherboard.
Yep.
If there is some new interface that we haven't thought of yet or that people aren't using yet and then comes out, you just build a little adapter and you're good to go. Now, I mean, I'd say build a little adapter. There's probably a whole lot more to it than that, but it gives current machines the capability of accessing this, just like we were doing with eSATA connections from our current MacBook Pros. You know, you could get an eSATA card for your Express Card slot and you were good to go. Now you would get an, you know, eSATA adapter for your Thunderbolt slot and off you go.
Right.
So it's definitely a cool thing. I was happy to see that come around. So yeah, good stuff.
All right. Off the tangent.
Back to,
Do we have another question?
We have plenty of questions.
We always have too many questions.
We've been geeky this show, so let's stay geeky and we'll go to Jeremiah. Jeremiah writes, and again, it's yet another one of those questions that turns us on to something cool. While asking a question, Jeremiah says, I have spent all morning troubleshooting this issue and I'm coming to you for some salvation. The problem is with my 27-inch 2.8 gigahertz iMac i7 with 8 gigs of memory and 1066 installed. I start it up and the hard drive never stops. It's constantly rattling and I'm at the end of my nerves with this. It's not just the rattling, but it causes applications like iTunes to skip and others like Mail to come up with a beach ball because of the constant access of the hard drive. Today, I reset the PRAM and SMC. I recently repaired disk permissions using an install disk. This happens just the same with a guest user account as well. Activity Monitor has not been very helpful to me. So I found an app called FS Eventer, and this is where I am stuck and perplexed. This app shows hard drive activity in a GUI, and it's awesome. And indeed, it is. It's the easiest way to see activity on your hard drive happening in real time. It builds it in a beautiful little kind of hierarchical GUI. It's awesome. So it was exactly the right thing to use here. And were this not a question, it would have been included in the next Cool Stuff Found show because FS Eventer definitely deserves a mention on its own. Moving on, he says, using FS Eventer under /private/var/TMP, I have a continuous flow of files that are being written and deleted. Each is formatted something like SQLite_ and then some alphanumeric sequence. I assume they are some database files, but I have no idea where they are coming from or how to stop them from being written. Okay, so you've done step one of the hard work, Jeremiah, is you figured out where the files are that are being written. The next question is, what is writing them? And there's two ways that I know of to do it. And then, John, I think you've got even a third. So the first would be, if you want to stay in the GUI, go to Activity Monitor. Now, this is going to be a bit tedious, but as you double click applications in the list in Activity Monitor, you get a little detail window up. And one of the tabs on that window is labeled Open Files and Ports. That will tell you which files are opened by that process. And you can look through the list and see, you know, just keep looking through the list for every single process that's running. Again, a tedious process. And look for the ones that are writing to private var temp and SQLite underscore whatever. That would help. But that's tedious. If you're willing to go to the terminal, though, there's a command that we've talked about before called LSOF or list open files. And if you simply run that command, it's going to list every open file on your machine. You could then use terminal's find function in the edit menu to search for SQLite or, you know, whatever path you want to search for. And it'll find it. And that would likely that'll likely, you know, point you right in the right direction, because on the line where it lists the file, it also lists the application that has it open. The last part I'll say is that if you're willing to go a little further with the terminal, you could type LSOF and don't hit enter yet. Hit space and then the pipe character, which is a shift and of the backslash, which is on most Apple keyboards above the return key. And then another space and then grep GREP space and then whatever you're looking for. What this does is it takes the output of that LSOF command and pipes it into an expression parser called grep. And then we're telling grep only show me the lines that, you know, in his example, if we type SQLite, it would, you know, only return those lines that are showing files with SQLite. And that could also help narrow it down. So that's my geeky answer for your excellent question. And again, thanks, Jeremiah, for turning us on to the FS Eventer. But John, you found one more terminal command, I think, right?
Well, I didn't find it. Jeremiah did. It's amazing. So yeah. Number one, FS Eventer was so awesome. I actually wrote a Monday's Mac Gadget last week about it. And I think one thing is that he may have been able to. So one of the features that's not immediately obvious with FS Eventer is if you see a file being created, if you hover the cursor over it, it will tell you the process that's creating that file. So I'm wondering.
Oh.
So maybe that would have helped him determine, yeah, it's you know, this app that's doing it. The other thing is that it buried in the preferences. Now, they warn against this, but I didn't see a reason not to. They have an option called list of all open files that is normally off, but you can turn on.
Ah.
So that's another one. But then again, Jeremiah, no, I'm going to give him two tips of the hat because he deserves it. And then the other thing is actually in our Twitter conversation with, which is of course through Mac Geek Gab, he indicated that he read a article, I believe it was at our arch nemesis at Macworld. No, just kidding. No, they're awesome. and this is another thing. So that's why I'm saying Jeremiah actually taught me more than we're going to teach him, I think. But I think we steered him in the right direction. But he indicated that he found a Macworld article that talked about a command called fs_usage.
Cool.
Which looks to me, Dave, I ran it. Now, you have to do a sudo before it because this is a command. Well, I think it just sucks it sucks processor. I mean, and it's showing you very intimate and a lot of unnecessary information. I think the article that he talked about actually helped you determine how to filter out all the bogus stuff. But I think if you want to know what's happening in your file system, which because FS, that's what that stands for,
right,
then fs_usage is a geeky way of, you know, if you want to know everything, I think that's the command. I think fs of enter is a good way. And of course, we'll link to the article I wrote. Fs of enter is a good way for a you know, average casual, or not even casual, because we're not, are we casual? I don't know.
Sure.
but aspiring geek to look at what's happening on the hard drive. And you saw it, Dave, I saw it. It's just amazing when you look at it, when you see, you know, the trees explode from the apps and stuff like that. And it retains things too, but it really gives you a sense of what's happening on your hard drive and who's doing what. And, you know, I think it's kind of beautiful.
Cool.
When I look at it. So, next.
I'm going to try something different here, John. Well, I want to talk about our next sponsor, which is Audio Engine. But I'm going to talk about this product by telling a story that solves a technical problem that I had. So we'll try this a little bit differently. I talk about the iMac in my kitchen all the time. And then, you know, that's what we play our music through. And it's actually just off the kitchen, but what have you. And I do. I have the Audio Engine A2 speakers there. So and you know, I've talked about that in other Audio Engine spots here before, and they work great. What I'm missing out on, though, is, you know, on the other side of the house is our living room, where we have our home theater set up and really nice speakers and all that. And I certainly can stream audio to my home theater via my TiVo. It's kind of a convoluted setup. I could do the same if I had an Apple TV, but it requires, you know, turning on the TV and navigating through and saying, yes, okay, go do this. And, you know, it's fine, but blah, whatever. It also doesn't allow me to play the audio in both places simultaneously, which would be really cool to be able to move from one room to the other of the house and hear sound coming out of speakers in different rooms, but have it all be in sync. So I got to thinking, well, wait a minute. You know, Audio Engine has this product called the AW, or the Audio Engine W1, which is a USB audio device. So when you plug it in, there's two pieces. You plug one into your Mac, and then the other you plug in to, it's got a mini 8 jack, and you plug that into your home stereo. I have it going mini 8 to RCA because that's the kind of jacks I have in my home stereo. And it sends audio wirelessly. And I think it'll send it about 100 feet. I'm certainly not having a problem in my home, and it does so with what they call no latency. I mean, I think there's obviously got to be some latency, but it's really, really, really low. So I could send audio from my iMac to the stereo in the living room. I don't need to turn on the TV and navigate anywhere to do it. I just kick on the receiver / amplifier, set it to the right channel, set it, tell it what input to use, and I'm good to go. So that was step one. And I'll tell you, the W1 works. It's awesome for this because the sound is good. It's full quality sound. And I just send it from my Mac and I choose that as my sound output and it works great. But I still haven't solved the problem of having it in both places. And that's actually where I used a piece of software called, oh, now I can't remember it, from Rogue Amoeba, Airfoil. That's right. And what Airfoil lets you do is send sound to remote computers. But what I did was I just set it up on the local machine and have it send sound to two sets of speakers on the local machine, because iTunes and the Mac OS in general won't let you send audio out more than one set of locally connected speakers. And again, that's what these AW1 appears as, just a locally connected USB speaker device. And but using Airfoil, I was able to foil the OS and have sound in both places. And it's awesome. So so this wireless W1 unit from Audio Engine is killer. Works great and makes life very, very easy for that. So again, it's all available at audioengineusa.com. The W1 is $99, and you can use our coupon code MGG10 for a 10% discount off of that price. So you got nothing to lose. They'll take it back if you don't like it. So it's all available at audioengineusa.com. We should answer a couple more questions here, John. It's been a while since we've been here, so maybe we got to go a little longer today.
Oh, we could. Now I'm wondering about the questions here, Dave. I see some. I don't know if I have a choice here.
Sure. Cast a vote.
Well, you know, it's a little on the
cast
agenda.
Cast a vote.
Jeff.
Oh, gosh, that's way off into Never Never Land. I don't
what?
Know.
No, it's not.
We can talk
it's
about
an easy
Jeff.
One.
It is an easy one. I'm just not sure to how many people it will apply, but
well, it's a fish. It's a fish shake. That's why I like it,
oh,
too.
Oh, boy. All right. So we're going to appease Mr. Braun on this one, folks. Bear with me. Jeff writes, I have an early 2008 20-inch iMac that's out of warranty. The original Western Digital Drive bricked. Died some weeks ago, and I've been running off an external USB drive. Last weekend, I installed a new Seagate 1 terabyte drive inside the machine. It works like a dream, except I have created a problem with the CPU fan. Namely, it ramps up to full speed at startup and stays there. I've tried pulling the machine apart two more times to ensure the sensors are correctly placed. They seem to be. I've reset the PRAM and SMC. I still can't figure it out. I ran the Apple hardware test, and it resulted in the following error code. 4SNS/1/4TLOP-130. I can't seem to figure out what this means, though I assume it's a sensor error. Any help would be appreciated. So, John, go.
Okay, very quickly, here's the problem. So some of the iMacs would have a hard drive with the temperature sensor, I think, part of the hard drive itself. Now, as it turns out, discussing this with Jeff, that was not the case.
Right.
So some Apple hard drives that they use have the temperature sensor in the drive. Some don't. Some have it externally. As it turns out, when I wrote back to him, he said, no, my drive is actually one that has the temperature sensor on the case of the drive. Here's the frustration, and here's the fish shake. So I found out, and it was through unnamed Apple sources, which I don't want to get them in trouble. But basically, I tossed out this error code to my network of confidential sources. And number one, here's the stupid thing, Dave, and this is the fish shake. The list of codes and what they mean have these big letters on them, and they spell out APPLECONFIDENTIAL.
I think that's Turkish.
No, it's Apple Confidential.
Oh,
it's like,
oh, that's right.
What the heck? So the thing is, if you get this code, and actually, no, you get this code when you run Apple hardware test, you don't know what it means. Now, Jeff, you know, was pretty keen in thinking, well, you see 4SNS. But basically, through my Apple sources, I found what this means is, dude, you busted the sensor, or the sensor is malfunctioning. So I think what happened is when he tried to replace the hard drive, whatever wiring was going to the sensor was somehow damaged. And that's what the machine is saying. And unfortunately, in this case, when the Mac thinks that a temperature sensor is not working, it will fall back to, which is probably somewhat sensible. It'll say, you know what? I'm going to assume that this machine is roasting and I'm going to run the fans at full speed. Now, as you and I and many others have seen, a Mac running the fans at full speed is not a pleasant experience.
Right. So, right.
Huh. To me, I just wanted to get that fish shake out there that couldn't the error code just say temperature sensor damaged, which is really, I think, what this meant. That's so inadvertently, what Jeff did is he probably pulled a wire or somehow, I don't know exactly, mucked up the wiring or the sensor itself. And that's why this is happening.
So, Jeff, I have an answer for solving your problem, though. And knowing that the sensor is going to continue to report erroneous data to the system, what you need to do is bypass the sensor and wrangle control of the fans.
He did that, I think.
Okay.
Actually, and, he got, well, are you going to say SMC?
No, I was going to recommend iStat menus. Because the new version of iStat menus, version 3.x, whatever it is now, has fan control, but it's got, it allows you to set different profiles. Right. So you can set, you know, a normal profile, an I'm running hot profile, and
sensor you can, broken.
Yeah. And you can change actually with this, you can only change the minimum speed. So maybe that isn't going to help. Maybe SMC fan control is the answer for you, Jeff.
And I think he tried that, but I think what has to happen is that sensor has to get replaced. And it sounds like inadvertently, you know, it was damaged. My understanding is AppleCare, if you call them, which of course has the access to the, you know, confidential error list, will say, oh yeah, send it in, we'll take care of it. So it's unfortunate, but I guess the message here is if you have an iMac of a recent vintage, be careful when you replace the hard drive because there may be a temperature sensor nearby.
Yeah.
And if you damage it, then you're going to get the airplane taking off effect when.
Yeah. And this is why Apple has these things listed as, you know, not user serviceable parts, because there are a lot of these minor little things that that seem minor at the time, and then once you're on your way out,
this. Now actually, I was helping my buddy Duffy, and actually, I was very happy. So he brought his wife's machine over for me to fix, and this is a tangent, but we'll get back to it. He brought his machine by and he said, and it's an iMac. Now, I don't have an iMac. You have an iMac, Dave, but I guess the reflection, and we'll wrap it up really quick. But he brought his machine over and he's like, you know, she's noticing slowdowns. And we pretty much quickly realized that the problem is he only has 1 gigabyte of RAM on the machine. Amazingly, the RAM chip I pulled out of my old MacBook Pro was the exact same type. Mm-hmm. So I made a donation to him. But my question to you, Dave, is you have one of these iMacs too, and is it, how easy is it to replace the hard drive?
Not.
Is it a bear?
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah, okay. I wouldn't do it. I would pay somebody to do it.
Got it.
Yeah. It's almost probably even worse than taking apart a laptop because the screen is so much bigger and you're constantly wrestling with that and it's got to be laying down. And yeah, taking apart any of these iMacs is not fun.
Got it.
Yeah. You know, and you know, go to your local, you know, the Apple store. Once you're out of warranty, the Apple store is tough, but find your local Apple authorized reseller and go to them because not only do they have all the knowledge and all the access to all the stuff that the geniuses do, but they're third parties. They're on their own and they can, for, you know, an hourly charge, fix your computer for you. So, you know, if I was to have to replace a hard drive in my iMac, I'd bring it down to my guy and, you know, I mean, maybe they charge me $100. I don't know, you know, whatever the hourly rate is, but they're doing it right because they're doing it per all of Apple's specs and they have all the access to all that stuff. So that really, to me, that's the way to do it. And anytime I've done it where I haven't gone to them first, I always wind up going to them in the end. So let's just put it that way. Mike has a good question. That's probably quite near and dear to many of our hearts. Right. Mike writes, do you guys have any suggestions on data recovery software? This is in relation to some accidentally deleted files. John, I'll let you go. And then I know you've got a recommendation and I'll make mine too.
Well, I'm sorry. I was responding to you.
Oh, go ahead, Mike, data recovery software, go.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, Mike. So Mike had a problem. This is terrible. Now, the one problem is when you delete files under any OS, let me bring it up here. Okay. When you delete a file under macOS 10 or any operating system, here's what happens, or pretty much any modern operating system. You're not really getting rid of the information. What you're doing is writing to the directory of the hard drive, which kind of keeps track of everything on the hard drive and saying, yeah, that this doesn't exist anymore. And by the way, if you need to use the space again, use it. Well, once that happens, it's kind of a roll of the dice whether, if and when the OS is going to rewrite that data, Dave. My recommendation would be, and I've had a long experience with these guys, but ProSoft Engineering makes something called Data Rescue. And that is the first thing I recommended to them. And actually, they have a demo. So I think Mike may have gotten away for nothing here, because their demo is limited to recovering a single file of 10 gigabytes or less.
Okay.
So he may have gotten away for nothing. But this is something I think anybody who, I don't know, if you manage computers and you have people that are, you know, deleting things right and left, which I don't know if you're in that environment, certainly an enterprise environment and even a home environment, if you're worried about losing data. And yet, I mean, the other thing I asked them, which, you know, of course he answered no. I'm like, well, did you back it up? And of course he said, well, no. So number one, make a backup, kids. Number two, this is a product, as far as I can tell, their methodology is they basically scour the hard drive. Because the problem is, the way hard drives work is there's a directory of what's on the hard drive, and then there's the data itself. And as far as I can tell, the way Data Rescue works is actually scours the drive and looks at the data. And maybe it looks at the directory, but it looks at the data and says, you know what, this data kind of looks like it may be a Word file or a JPEG file or this file or that file, and it'll attempt to recover it. The thing I got to state is that once you delete a file, you know, it's hit or miss.
Right.
Because if and when the OS decides to wipe out either the directory entry or the data, when it's gone, it's gone. So.
Right. That's right. Yeah. You know, when this came in, I thought, oh, yeah, you know, there really is nothing good. And then I remembered Mac Keeper, which we've known about for a while. And I got to talk to those guys at Macworld Expo, and we even talked about it at the cool stuff found at Macworld Expo. Mm-hmm. And they Mac Keeper has undelete functionality built right into it. And I asked him about it when I talked to him. I said, okay, well, what are you guys doing? Are you doing some magic here? What are you doing? He said, well, we're doing kind of what you described ProSoft is doing, right? Where you can go out and scour for types of files and that sort of thing. But also, once you've installed Mac Keeper, it can use FS events, which we talked about earlier in the show, to track a deleted file and actually bring it back that way. So a much smoother process. And I have yet to test this, actually, but they were showing it to me. I tested it with them on their computers. I haven't tested it on mine, but they were showing it to me there, and it worked great. I mean, the file goes away, you empty it from the trash, as long as you bring it back relatively quickly.
Right.
And again, that speaks to what you were saying, John, about how, you know, this stuff, once it's marked as available, anything can write to it. And that's sort of the risk, but as long as it hasn't been overwritten, yeah, Mac Keeper just brings it right on back. So it's cool stuff. I definitely, you know, the more I have used that Mac Keeper thing, the happier I've been with it. Yeah, it's good. That's good. And it's, you know, it's funny because we were talking in the pre-show about this, and John, you expressed some concerns about it because they're a new company, and I felt exactly the same way.
Well, that's my only concern.
Right.
They're new. ProSoft is an old friend of ours.
Right.
We've known them for years. We see them in Macworld. We see them year after year. These guys, and I remember getting, and I think you may have too, I get emails out of the blue from this company saying, yeah, hey, we got this, utility that does everything. And again, I think it's safe to say I was a bit nervous. I mean, well, who are these guys?
But
it sounds like you met with them and you talked to them, and it sounds like at the very least they know what they're doing.
Well, here's the thing. You know, I was one of the first people to start singing the praises of Onyx, right? I used Cocktail for a long time. And that was written, Cocktail's written by a Russian guy, I think, right? And then we moved to Onyx, or I moved to Onyx because it was free. Right. And it did all the things that I needed Cocktail to do. But, you know, I've never been able to talk to the developer of Onyx. I mean, it's a company in France.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I don't. Maybe I've gotten a reply from him, but I don't think so.
Oh, well,
so.
The French are even worse than the Russians. Oh, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
People just don't even write the emails. I'm just kidding. That's right. Sorry. Move on.
But you know, so we try, you know, I was thinking about this after we did our pre-show and kind of before we started recording. I'm like, oh, yeah, why do I, you know, what? You know, where's the line that makes me go from questioning a company to trusting it? And the same thing has happened with Matt Keeper. You know, at first it was like, well, who are these guys? And then, like I said, I met with them and I feel a whole lot better about the product. I've used it some. I haven't used it for this, but I've used it for some other stuff. And you know, I was thinking, well, Onyx, we recommend without even thinking about it. And yet these developers are, you know, probably no bigger than and maybe much smaller than the folks at Zeobit that make Mac Keepers. So right. Yeah, it's interesting how the mind plays these games. So we have one last question from Hugh.
Oh my gosh.
And Hugh says, I recently got a spare 1 terabyte Seagate expansion external drive for Time Machine. I've had my iMac 21-inch i3 since August of 2010. I've done an erase and install of Mac OS X, and then I tried to run Time Machine through the setup installer, but it wasn't being picked up for some reason. Sorry, I think Hugh's native language is not English, and I'm trying my darndest to make sense of this. So bear with me. So I logged on and tried to do it in Migration Assistant once I had reinstalled Mac OS X. It was picked up in Migration Assistant, but as I was using my full name as my logon, and the original logon was also that, I quit my Migration Assistant and went into accounts and renamed my account from my full name to just my first name. This time it picked it up without a hitch and went and reinstalled everything from Migration Assistant. It wasn't until a couple of hours later that I tried to use Dashboard. I downloaded and installed a new widget. I tried to open the newly installed widget, but it crashes. And Hugh sent a little video. So here's what happened. Hugh couldn't get Migration Assistant to work during the installation process. So instead then went and created a new account and ran Migration Assistant from inside that account. When you do that, now you'll wind up with two accounts on the system, potentially, especially the path that Hugh took. And more importantly, user accounts on Mac OS X are assigned, as they are on any Unix, are assigned an account ID. And the first account created is account 501. So if you only had one account on the previous machine, it was user ID 501. So that would have been the same with Hugh's initial account that he created. When Migration Assistant creates a new account, it's 502. So sometimes that's going to cause a permission issue, especially if a file is brought over, is owned by 501, but it's part of account 502, and it can cause quite a few issues. So in theory, a permissions reset will fix this. I think what he showed us was when he was trying to add the widget to the dashboard, it would just close. Nothing would happen. He'd click the little button and it would close. Try to drag it into the dashboard and it would close. And I think it's a permissions issue. So a permissions repair might fix this, but what you might need to do is have the permissions file completely recreated. And it's, again, in Home Library Preferences. It's called com.apple.dashboard.plist. And there's also com.apple.dashboard.client.plist. Delete both of those files, reboot your Mac, and in theory, that should allow the file to be created and, more importantly, modified, which will allow you to put new things back into the dashboard. So I think that's the magic answer there.
I think you're right.
Yeah, you don't have any further thoughts on that?
No, that's why I said I think you're right.
All right, good. There's the band. Contact information, you can email us to feedback@macgeekgab.com.
No, it's feedback@macgeekgab.com.
That's right, John. It's feedback@macgeekgab.com for your questions, your comments, your tips, your screenshots, your movies, whatever else it is you want to send through. You can call us at 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is...
of course, 4335.
And you can Skype us to Mac Geek Gab. You can also find us on Twitter. John, tell us about Twitter.
Twitter. Well, it's this thing.
Okay, good. Tell them how to find us on Twitter.
Of course I will. I am John F. Braun. Dave Hamilton is Dave Hamilton. Mac Geek Gab is Mac Geek Gab. Mac Observer is Mac Observer. Pilot Pete, who is not here, sadly, he's probably piloting. It's Pilot Pete. It couldn't be any easier.
All of those are at twitter.com, of course. The wehavecommunicators.com is the home of the podcast that Michael Johnston creates. He's also the one that converts this to AAC enhanced mode for all of you. So thank you very kindly, Michael. And Cashfly at cashfly.com provides all the bandwidth. The podcast marketplace this month, of course, includes the A2 speakers and W1 from Audio Engine, Yojimbo from Barebone Software, PDF Pen from Smile, and Notebook from Circus Ponies, all through Backbeat Media. And with that, folks, we are out of here. I can go rest my throat now. I brought back this great souvenir from San Francisco. Can't you hear it, everybody?
Yeah. Did you bring me one?
Oh, yeah. I'll share.
No.
This cold is mine. I'm not sharing it with anybody. Except maybe my wife and kids. We'll see you next time, folks. Next Monday for the next Mac Geek Gab. Regular and Thursday for Mac Geek Gab Premium.